Maybe it might be an idea to trade off Triton. Is that a point at which Zumwalt or somebody steps in and tries to nip this idea in the bud, or
yeah,
you just monitor?
But that, you know, that gets a little farther down the lines. Let me open up and discuss that for just a minute. And let me talk about MERS a little bit.
Okay.
Because after we were maybe 6 or 8 months into SALT II, Kissinger started to get this fascination with the MERS business and perceived that as the number one problem to be solved in the SALT II. And more important, in fact, than getting a permanent comprehensive agreement to supersede the interim agreement. And the reason he felt this way, at least this is the way he explained it, was that the Soviets were coming along more rapidly than we anticipated in the MERS testing area. We were facing an opportunity to limit their MERS deployments, which, unless it were seized now, would be lost to us permanently. And the reason for that was that the Soviets had not yet reached the point of deploying any operational MERS systems. They were in the test phase, and while they were in the test phase, we could monitor what they were doing with reasonable accuracy. And we knew that until the systems were perfected and they had had a given number of satisfactory flight tests of them, and from past history we knew roughly, in our own experience, we knew roughly what that number of tests was, and we were able to evaluate their tests that went along with regard to success or failure. They weren't yet at the point where they perfected the systems. His argument was, if we can get them right now to stop their flight testing, then they can't deploy the MERS systems, and therefore the strategic balance will not be affected by Soviet, to our disadvantage, by Soviet MERS deployments. So his argument was we should go to them with a proposal right now for both sides to stop all MERS flight testing, and, you know, recognizing its impact would be astronomical, affect the Soviets much more than us, because we already had Minuteman III perfected in the process of deployment. Poseidon was in the process of deployment. It would, of course, preclude development of new MERS systems on our part, including the Triton system. The JCS opposed this proposal on the grounds that...
In the verification panel.
In the VPWG and subsequently in the verification panel. On the grounds that... Oh, there were a whole variety of arguments, but what they boiled down to was this. First of all, we didn't have enough confidence in our intelligence about how far along the Soviets were to be sure that we could detect covert deployments by them of MERS system. You know, they were far enough along that if they wanted to take a little risk, and indeed they might be farther along than we perceive, but even not crediting them with too much capability, if they want to take a risk and go ahead and deploy the systems covertly now without further flight testing, they might wind up with a very real MERS capability that we wouldn't even be aware of. The second point was that Kissinger proposed limiting only ICBM MERS flight testing on the Soviet side, because he didn't think we would agree to a complete foreclosure of MERS testing. And that if the Soviets were allowed to go ahead and test SLBM MERS, where they could subsequently transfer the technology from the submarine missile force to the ICBM force, or even just deploy SLBMs in ICBM silo where MERS capability that way.
Is this all kind of indisputable fact, or is this an interpretation of fact?
Is what?
The capacity to deploy SLBMs and ICBM things and that kind of stuff.
No, that's, I would put that in the category of fact.
You really can't do that.
Yeah, you really
You can transfer your MRF from one thing to another.
Yeah, you really, Once you've got, you know, a MRF warhead.
And no serious technological arguments to refute that.
No. And there were no, there were some uninformed arguments by non-technical people that, this wasn't the case, but there was consensus. I've got complete agreement among the technical people that this sort of technology transfer was quite feasible.
It was quite feasible.
And essentially undetectable, assuming the Russians took precautions to keep it from our observation. And on top of that, and this was the weakest and least important of the JCS arguments, JCS said, we don't perceive this urgency about the need for a MIRV agreement that Kissinger does. And beyond that, we just philosophically don't believe that qualitative limitations on strategic forces are a good idea, because they prevent force modernization over a period of time, and the historical record tends to show that force modernization is a good thing in the sense that it allows you to reduce the cost of maintaining your strategic forces, and it also tends to result in more stability in the strategic balance. Well, that's an academic argument. It's not a military argument. That comes from people like Wallstar. The JCS endorsed the argument, and they believe that this is the case. Well, despite...
Well, there is ground for legitimate difference of opinion about that.
Yeah, there are certain aspects of it. There is others, I think, the evidence is pretty clear.
Did delegation take the lead in these, in this particular JCS position? Was he fighting the battle of the Hicks Committee at that point?
No, Zumwalt took the lead in the sense of arguing most vigorously down in the tank for a strong expression of JCS views on this particular subject. Now, often JCS positions, particularly if they're reactive in the sense of responding to some specific initiative that's come from Kissinger through the BP apparatus, the positions get generated automatically. You know, the system just produces a draft position.
Yeah.
Then the JCS look at it and decide whether that in fact reflects their views.
Yeah.
And quite often the product that they get is of very poor quality, and it requires a lot of reworking by the chiefs themselves sitting down there on the table. And Zumwalt, as the most articulate of the chiefs and the best informed on this particular subject, was able to dominate the discussion and exert a lot of leadership to guide the JCS position.
Did he get to, had this group here provided him with?
Yeah.
Stuff at that point?
They provided him with some pretty detailed inputs, both for the purpose of education, his own education, and for the purpose of focusing his thinking towards specific positions.
Am I correct in assuming then that when some issue would surface over there at the VPWG or the VP or something, that, that this would provoke a certain amount of activity in the sub panel here? And
yeah. That's right.
That is indeed what happened.
That's exactly what happened. Anyway, despite the views of the JCS, Kissinger...
So you were a kind of a competitive working group in a way.
Yeah. Kissinger promulgated what's called a NISDM, an SDM, which is a National Security Decision Memorandum. These things are highly classified, and their distribution is very limited.
This is presumably signed by the president himself, right?
Well, it presumably represents a presidential decision. They're often signed by Kissinger for the president. And while it was never quite clear whose decision it was, so people just had to
assume. Obviously, it was not put out without the president knowing it, though.
I wouldn't say obviously. I would say that's an open question. you know, I have no evidence one way or the other. But as time went on, one got the impression that the president had turned the Seoul area over almost completely to Kissinger,
and was not
following it in any detail at all. And the main evidence on this is on those rare occasions where there were NSC meetings, there were many more BP meetings than there were NSC meetings. NSC meetings in Seoul were extremely rare. When they occurred, people who attended them got the distinct impression that the president was very poorly informed on the issues under discussion.
This was something that developed over time, then, because at the beginning he was quite in the middle of it, wasn't he? At least Newhouse gets that impression.
I have no authority other than Newhouse to fall back on. Yeah. I wasn't around then, and I don't.
Newhouse does give that impression.
Yeah, he does give that impression. Yeah. But, you know, remember that that's
where Newhouse got most of his
stuff. He was drawing on one source primarily, and that's a semi-official history of what went on during that period.
Yeah. He did check around in other places, and he did talk to a lot of other people.
I don't know.
There's internal evidence that he did. He quotes Russ, he quotes.
I suppose he did, yeah. That's just like the argument that the Cal brothers got into last night. I don't know if you saw them on Channel 46. They were being attacked by Peter Visigor and what's his name, Lebowski, about their book on Kissinger.
Well, that seems to be more than semi-official.
That was the argument. It was not really a good journalistic job because they relied too heavily on a single source. Anyway, a NISDM came out. And NISDMs can cover a whole... NISDMs can address anything in the national security area. But one thing that NISDMs are used for is to provide definitive guidance to the Seoul delegation on what the U.S. and OSCE position is. So a NISDM came out saying to offer this test ban proposal to the Russians. It was offered, and the Russians evidenced absolutely no interest in it whatsoever.
Must be very frustrating, just in a human way, to agonize for 3 months over what you're going to say to the Russians, and then they look and yawn and walk out the door. Yeah. But what strain? Negotiating itself must be a terribly strenuous thing to do. And I guess Kissinger's good at that.
You guess what?
He's good at it. He has the physical and emotional stamina to sit through an awful lot of garbage. He must have been in the middle in the Yom Kippur War thing.
There are people who would disagree with that. Yeah.
There are people who disagree with anything.
There are people who would disagree with a characterization of him as a good negotiator in the sense that if you judge him by the results of the negotiation, the results are not good. If he were a good negotiator, he would get better results than the results that he gets. So, the Russians evidence no interest in that.
Yeah.
We then went back in early in 73 with a detailed draft treaty.
Merv ban.
Well,
Merv testing ban.
No. We proposed that, the Russians rejected it, that was kind of the end of that.
We dropped it.
We then went in with a rather detailed draft treaty with the thought that that would serve as the vehicle for at least some serious discussion.
This with JCS concurrence?
No, it wasn't.
What?
No, it wasn't. We were confronted with a fait accompli. Nobody knew that it was coming or knew what the terms
this
were.
This one hadn't surfaced in the verification panel.
All of a sudden, there was this message
out of a hat
to the delegation saying, here's what we want you to propose to the Russians.
And it really was detailed. I mean, a lot of people did a lot of work had done it.
Well, no, I wouldn't say a lot of work had gone into it because a detailed treaty, only runs on this on an issue like this only runs for 5 or 6 single space pages. It's something you could sit down and typewrite and knock out in 2 hours if you weren't too concerned about how sound it was going to be. And I think critics would say that this draft bore all the earmarks of something that was very hastily.
But it did come as a complete surprise.
Yeah, it came as a complete surprise. Something was hastily put together by people over there on the NSC staff.
Your spy system, if you'll pardon the expression, did not uncover this one.
It wasn't working very well on that TV. So, we presented this to the Russians. We presented a detailed supporting rationale that was worked up by the delegation pertaining to each one of the articles. It left the Russians cold. They said,
yawned at that one, too.
Said, well, that's a non-starter. So, go back to the drawing board. So then the focus shifted
back.
Are
the provisions of that proposed treaty a highly secret thing at this point? I mean,
not that I care what
I wouldn't call them highly secret. After all, the Russians know what we propose. So what are we revealing if we publish it? It provided for equal aggregates. It had a MERV provision, which was probably pretty well balanced. It had a lot of other provisions, which were sort of fill-in-the-blanks or multiple-choice provisions that had some generalized language, but then with the specifics being negotiated and subsequently, if the Russians agreed in principle to this, to that particular approach.
Didn't address itself to FBS, though, or
no. We finally developed for FBS what's called a bond circumvention formula, which means that we will agree, and we propose this to the Russians, that they haven't had any standing interest in it. This means that we will agree that we will not in the future circumvent the central strategic balance by deploying any additional forward-based systems. And we'll maintain the status quo with FBS.
Was this checked without with NATO?
After the fact, it was. We told them afterwards what we had done, and they agreed to it. They said, that's fine. That's a perfectly sensible approach to the problem.
Well, if your account is accurate, I mean, if your whole theory is accurate more than your account, I'm sure your account is, the time that the Russians will stop yawning at everything we say will be precisely the time at which they have MERV deployed.
Well, it'll be that point, or it'll be at the point where we come in with an agreement which, in terms of which they find attractive.
But actually, they're not going to find any terms attractive except a total giveaway at this point until they have MERV deployed.
I think there is a range. We could identify a range within which the Russians would agree to any one of several possible formulations of an agreement. And there's kind of a maximum that they would like very much to have the agreement reflect, and there's a minimum beyond which they will not go. And quite clearly, that minimum is one which would let them go ahead and carry out all of their MERV deployment plans, essentially MERV their whole ICBM force, and keep a significant quantitative margin in terms of missiles.
You think that's enough?
Yeah, over us.
About merging the whole SLBM too, or is that not as important to them?
I don't think that's as important to them. At least they haven't given the indication that it's as important to them. and with their throw weight advantage, which resides in their ICBM force, if they could MIRV that whole force, then even though we had our SLBMs MIRV, they would still have a warhead advantage over us because of throw weight difference.
But they would not have a first strike. I mean, we'd still have the assured destruction bit, right, with our C thing.
Yeah.
So presumably there would still be a balance of sorts.
Yeah, you know, when you use the word balance, then it becomes kind of tricky. Now, you talked about assured destruction. Well, that's
Newhouse's.
Yeah, sure. That was our announced strategy up until quite recently. That was the McNamara buzzword that was carried over under the Nixon administration until just about 2 years ago, when we evolved a new strategy, something that has been called the Schlesinger strategy, you know, the flexible options for nuclear delivery systems, and the idea of a response or use of nuclear forces less than an all-out strategic exchange, that sort of thing, and that he has argued, for which he has presented the rationale to Congress and in some of his public pronouncements. And actually, although it's been attributed to Schlesinger, because we went public with it at about the time he became Secretary of Defense, it was worked out before he ever came into the Pentagon. A study group had been working it up for about a year before that.
None of us study group, one of yours?
Oh, no, no. This was a DOD group with JCS participation, some NSC staff participation. It was a Kissinger initiative, as a matter of fact. And Johnny Foster, who was the Director of Defense Research and Engineering, and Joe Mountain Curry took over that job, was the head of this group. And the charter for the group said, in essence, assured destruction is no longer an adequate national strategy because it doesn't give the president options. You know, he only has one button on his desk that says, you push this button and we launch everything we've got to try to kill as many Russians and blow up as many of their cities as possible. And the situation may not evolve, you know, if we really get into a showdown with the Russians, it may not evolve in such a way that we want to push that button. And we want to have things, gradations of that possibility, things, options short of that, that we can resort to. So our forces should be structured, our command and control system should be structured, our strategy should be structured to support a whole array of options.
Yeah, but I can see that, but all the same, at the as in the new jargon, the bottom line is still the ability to respond to a massive first strike with a very destructive second strike, right?
Yeah.
In spite of whatever else may be a superstructure on that, you've got to have that, don't you?
Yeah.
You can't do anything unless you have that, right? I mean, you're in no position to do anything unless
that's the maximum capability.
Yeah.
All of these are portions of that capability.
And even though it's true that you should be able to do other things short of that, you still have to be able to do that.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Now, nobody is saying that is a capability which we do not want to possess any longer. There are rather subtle shifts of emphasis in saying that assured destruction, if you still want to use that term, doesn't necessarily mean killing the maximum number of Russians possible.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe that isn't the best way to deter the Russians, because the Russian value system is different. The human life has less value to the Russians than it does to us. And what is more important to the Russians is probably their military capability and the industrial or the economic potential that supports that war-making capability. So you should, you know, that's what the target is. That's what you want to go after, rather than
so assured destruction then gets refined to mean an appropriate response to whatever they do.
Yeah. It means a response which will take out, which will destroy to the maximum extent possible their war-making capability and their ability to function as an organized society and economy.
Yeah.
That's right. Rather than killing people.
However,
a lot of people are going to get killed in the process.
The second part involves killing a lot of people.
Sure. But anyway, this is just kind of a footnote to the broader discussion. That's a Kissinger strategic initiative, not a specialist strategic initiative.
Yeah.
But since it turned out to be a something of a controversial policy, Kissinger has been quite happy to let Schlesinger stay out front on it. And Kissinger has not publicly associated himself with that policy.
Well, this is not a policy with which Dumwalt, this is from which he dissents.
Not at all. No, the chiefs are entirely on board.
The chiefs are on board with that.
Anyway,
but that makes it a little more complicated. I see. It makes the negotiations a lot more complicated, doesn't it? The shapes of the forces are not as simple as if it was just bang, bang, bang and counter bang.
To go back to the Merv business, after we went through this drill of trying to sign them up to the test ban, that didn't succeed. Getting them interested in talking about the terms of comprehensive treaty, that didn't succeed. You know, instead of serious dialogue, all we got was a lot of rhetoric coming back from them. Then Kissinger focused once more on the Merv issue and said, again, all right, you know, let's forget this idea of getting a comprehensive treaty. Let's see if we can't get agreement on Mervs alone. And recognizing that by this point, the Soviet testing had gone past the point where a test ban would have accomplished anything useful. Said, let's see if we can't get them to agree to put a limit on their Merv deployments in exchange for something. We've got to figure out what it is we can give them as well. Make this an attractive deal to them. Well, the JCS and OSV went back and said, look, let me ask you again, why is this such a terribly urgent problem that we have to abandon the objective of a comprehensive agreement and devote all our energies to the Merv problem. Yeah. I know. Pretty good. How are things over there? Let me just ask you something about your approach to this subject. Are you contemplate that after you have a feel for Zumwalt's role in this whole thing and discuss with him that you will be coming back to get more specific detail about some aspects of this, because I'm sort of deliberately avoiding getting into a lot of detail at this point.
I suppose that's right. He's going to. After all, he's the source of everything.
Yeah.
One or the other of us will, I presume, be coming back for chapters and verses. Yes.
Okay.
Because one thing is very clear, and that is that the more the dates and places and people can be specified, the more credibility
asking you is whether you're looking for that kind of detail today.
What I'm looking for today is aid in composing an outline for the book.
Right.
A chapter on this. Okay. Where are the chapters, and where is the sequence of the narrative, and what comes first and what comes second, and what's important and what is trivial from the point of view of his particular role and participation, in other words, what I'm really most interested in hearing, I'm very interested in hearing the substantive thing as it went on, but what I'm most of all interested in hearing is what he was doing in the course of all this, how much of this was something that he actively concerned himself with and did things about, and how much of it was just stuff that went by him, or that he didn't think was worth jumping into. That's is salt the kind of thing? I just have an editorial bias about it, you know, or an editorial point of view. Is salt going to be one chapter or six chapters? Yeah. Is what I'm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, with regard to salt, too, up to the point that we have reached in the tale, his principal role was as a member of the JCS, sitting down there in the tank, arguing with the other chiefs, exhorting them to take sound positions and to think through the problem carefully.
He was and keeping himself as informed as he could.
Oh, yeah, and using his own knowledge to educate the other chiefs properly and the vehicle of these.
Have you any idea how they reacted to this? Is there anything, in other words, for the book in the relationship in the Joint Chiefs at this point on this subject or on any subject? Or is that just something you don't know about?
Well, I've got a lot of specifics about, you know, on given occasions in relation to certain issues, how each of the chiefs reacted to the problem and how they reacted to what they were hearing from Zumwalt. And I'm sure he can recollect a lot of specifics also. But Zumwalt's method was, well, he was, you know, was to have start out each day with a meeting, 7 o'clock in the morning, with his vice chief, with his director of program planning, who is sort of the chief of staff for the Navy staff, with his executive assistant, and
was that Tit?
Who?
Which program planning?
No, it was Worth Bagley.
Oh, with Bagley.
Until a year and a half ago, and then it was a fellow named Tom Hayward who has the job currently. And with his executive assistant, who's now Admiral Bert Shepard, and was succeeded by Captain Don Pringle, and myself. And the day would start with a very detailed debrief by Zumwalt of his activities during the preceding 24 hours since last we had met with him. He was very meticulous. He kept good notes on anything of significance, any conversation, any decisions he'd made, guidance he'd given, meetings he'd gone to. He would run them down, and this would take anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour and 15 minutes, depending on how busy this day had been. And he's the most careful guy I've ever seen in this regard. He was very anxious that his subordinates know in detail exactly what he had been involved in, and that they have the same database from which to operate in supporting him that he had himself.
Was this a monologue, or did he solicit comment?
It was usually a monologue. But anyway, if there had been a meeting of the chiefs or anything else relating to salt, it would all come out in these sessions. And he's got, I think, pretty detailed notes of them, and I've got pretty detailed notes of them, particularly the areas that I was interested in acting. And this is where these recollections about reactions of specific people would come from.
Well, that's good to know that there are such notes, right?
Sometimes, as he went along, he would ask questions or direct specific observations to members of the group, and he'd relate something that had been told to him and say, is that correct? How do you feel about that? What should we do about that? But mainly it was just some length, and then he would go around the room, and each guy there would have a chance to comment on anything that he had heard from Zumwalt, or to bring to Zumwalt's attention things that were going to happen that day, or issues in kind of a decision point, things that Zumwalt should be aware of. And that would take maybe another 15, 20, 25 minutes. After which Zumwalt.
Was there any constraint about telling him exactly what you thought, or was he going to level with?
On the contrary, it was expected and encouraged. Then he would have, when that was over, about another half dozen people would come in, other staff assistants, the legislative liaison guy and his press man and some of his personal aides. And they would all give little brief 30-second, 1-minute reports to him on things that he ought to know as he started that day. His press guy would spoke the longest, would give him maybe 5 minutes worth of what was in the morning newspaper, which was pertinent to them all, or the Navy, the Army. So by 8:30 in the morning, he was well pumped up and ready to go out and do battle.
Sounds like about time to go to bed.
May exhausted by that time. But it was, you know, it was just terribly helpful to me personally in trying to serve the guy effectively to have the benefit of all of that information flowing back.
Oh yeah, it must have been great.
And I think it was a good management technique on his part.
7 in the morning sounds a little early.
I often went in there at 7 o'clock kind of glad that he was going to do the talking for the first half hour. Give me a chance to wake up a little bit.
You don't really go on many wild parties during the week of that schedule, can you?
Really can. How did Zimmo question, how did Zimmo influence what was going on in the Salt Lake? In addition to his discussions down in the tank, he would talk to other people around town and express his concern about the way things were going in the Salt area and express his philosophy on how he thought we should be handling it.
Did he try to maintain a constituency in Congress for his views about Salt? Was he talking to people like Jackson all the time?
Sure. Yeah. What? And it wasn't so much a question of cultivating a constituency, because the constituency already existed, and its leader was Jackson, who was one of the best informed guys in the country.
He had his own sources of information.
Jackson, by virtue of his chairmanship of the Permanent Investigations Committee of the Government Operations Subcommittee of the Government Operations Committee, has got certain responsibilities related to intelligence agencies. And as a result, he has got carte blanche with CIA, for example, to call for any intelligence he may have in any area that interests him. And he uses that as a medium to ensure that he stays fully informed on what the Soviets are doing in this particular area. Now,
well, if Kissinger really wants to cut Jackson out and wants to black him out about information, can he do it?
No, he couldn't do it, because Jackson would roll the kiss of his head and go right to the president and say, your national security system is acting in a way which is offensive to one of the most influential Democrats in Congress. He wouldn't put it in those blunt terms, but that would be the message which would be conditioned. He probably wouldn't have to make it explicit at all. I mean, the president... Nixon.
Nobody would try to do anything to Jackson.
He could just make life too difficult for the president. The president's programs.
Well, did you think Jackson knew about those back channel negotiations?
That gets into a whole different subject area, and let me just summarize it by saying that there were two problems about that existed throughout SALT II and that exist today. With regard to the flow of information to appropriate people in the government. On the executive branch side, Congress set up the National Security Council system, the National Security Act of 48 and its amendments. It said that there's certain orderly procedures which we want followed in order to ensure that all of the elements of the government which have something to contribute in this area participate in the decision-making process, and that the president has the benefit of balanced advice. And as part of that process, the JCS are given certain very clear statutory obligations relating to the provision of military advice to the president. Under Kissinger, that that system, I think by design, did not function the way it apparently was intended to function and the way it had functioned in previous administrations. In the sense that the use of the NSC and its subsidiary panels as a vehicle for working out some sort of consensus of agency views was discouraged and frustrated by Kissinger's style of operation. The NSC meetings became what I can only characterize as a complete farce.
Yeah, of course, so Kennedy and Johnson didn't call many of them either, did they? NSC meetings? Or a few of them. I mean, the whole apparatus went downhill after Eisenhower.
I don't think it's not so much a question of the number or frequency of the meetings, but the spirit in which they were conducted. And the use of the council as a medium to reconcile divergent viewpoints. Well, first of all, to ensure the presentation of divergent viewpoints to the president, and then some attempt for the reconciliation in order to make decisions. I think when you look at the way Kennedy operated, for example, during some of his previous crises, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, he made a deliberate effort to solicit a wide variety of viewpoints and encouraged differences of opinion.
Yeah.
And then having aired all of the possibilities and listened to the various viewpoints, made up his mind what he was going to do. The NSC under Nixon became the platform for announcing pre-formed presidential decisions on issues, rather than a vehicle for airing differences. The verification panel, as time went on, increasingly became that kind of a medium also.
How do you reconcile what you are saying with what Newhouse says very persuasively, which is that what Nixon, Kissinger, objected to about the Johnson style was that Johnson always insisted that he be presented with a consensus, and as a result, many things fell out in the cracks, many points of view that would have been important for him to hear never got up to his level because of this mad effort to make a consensus, and that what Nixon, Kissinger wanted was not a consensus, but a bunch of options. That's Newhouse's account.
I would say that I simply disagree with that description of the situation. As it applies to SALT.
As it applies to SALT.
Yeah.
And that the object of the whole verification panel and working group was to work up options which could then be presented to the president. You can do A, B, C, D, and E, and then Newhouse does go at the beginning of SALT 1, if there was A, B, C, D, and E, and 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5.
I just can't really speak from any first-hand knowledge about how SALT things one, were in SALT 1. But your best source on that is Zumwalt. But I think that what you will hear from them is that there really wasn't much significant difference between the way the system operated in SALT 1 and in SALT 2.
Yeah.
On the congressional side.
Well, he obviously wasn't trying to be. Obviously, in the Kissinger Nixon style, was not to reach a consensus. It was to.
Well, I wouldn't call it the Nixon Kissinger style.
I'd call it the Kissinger style.
Because I think Nixon was getting his input from a single source, and that source was Kissinger. And because of the characteristic isolation in which Nixon operated.
Yeah.
He didn't know, and from all indications, didn't particularly care whether what he was getting was a consensus or not.
Yeah, he was at the, he was at the mercy of whatever Kissinger,
whatever guy had immediate access to him and responsibility for that particular area.
Yeah, right.
And
that I believe. That I believe about Nixon.
Kissinger's whole philosophy about salt was that salt, the real issue is not salt, but detente.
Yeah.
And that salt should not be allowed to interfere with or spoil the atmosphere at the time.
That's okay.
But, you know,
someone has said that, but it's something that I haven't fixed firmly enough in my head yet. Yeah. But,
the great event of the last several years was